Okay, so the next speaker is Penny Probert-Smith. She will be presenting a method for robust minimum variance beamformer and its applications to MEG and local field potential.
Stand a bit sideways from the laptop because I can't actually see over it. Okay, so I'm going to present some work which we've been doing in Oxford between a group of us. So Hamid Masseini is the mathematician, really. He's done most of the work on the details of the beamforming, so I will go a bit fast over that. We're also working with the Department of Psychiatry. I'm in engineering, I'm Penny Probert-Smith. And Tipu Aziz is one of the leading surgeons working in the Radcliffe Hospitals Trust in Oxford in deep brain stimulation. So this is a fairly clinically based talk in a sense. We've got a clinical problem, which is to do with deep brain stimulation, and we're trying to image it using MEG, magnetoencephalography. So I'll start with a bit of discussion on background, and then I'll move on to the beamforming, and then I'll give you some results. Those are just our affiliations. So deep brain stimulation is a technology whereby they plant electrodes into the brain. So at the top here, you can see the electrode coming in at the top and coming down. It's used in the treatment of quite a number of neural disorders. In particular, we use it in Oxford for Parkinson's disease. Probably the most common, both for dealing with tremor, it actually suppresses tremor, and dealing with other motion problems like dystonia and akinesia. The application I'm going to be talking about today is pain, and if we say that odor is actually very person dependent, well, pain is incredibly, the perception of pain is also extremely subjective. Some people seem to cope very well with pain, and others find it very difficult to handle. It's also used in some other areas, such as multiple sclerosis and other neural disorders. So no one really understands how it works. What you do is you implant the electrodes into the brain, and we're looking here at deep brain stimulation, so your signals actually coming out eventually are very small. So the electrode's implanted. They then put on a 5-volt sine wave, normally 5 volts, so it can vary a bit, at a frequency between about 50 hertz and 130 hertz. And then really they go through a period of this, so they implant the electrodes by surgery. There's then a period where they're what's called externalized, where you have access to the stimulator and access to the signals coming off the implanted electrodes, the local field potentials. And during that time they titrate, so they try and decide the best signal for the patient. And then after that they implant a battery and everything becomes, they bring the wires down inside, everything becomes internalized. So the work we do is really trying to get hold of that externalized period so we can actually look at the local field potentials of the electrodes and use those to try to improve our beamforming. So MEG, magnetoencephalography, a fairly new technology, picking up magnetic fields of the order of femto Gauss. So that's about eight orders of magnitude smaller than the Earth's magnetic field. So essentially you put a number of magnetometers and gradiometers around the head and a sort of skull cap. The person sits inside the machine, which we can see at the bottom here. And from these very small signals, then we try to reconstruct the sources within the brain. And the point of that really is twofold. One is to improve the surgery so they know better where to aim for. And the other one is to try to understand more about the neural processes. So there's quite a few difficulties with DBS. One is we're looking at very small signals. We expect most of the excitation of the brain to come from the region around the electrodes. Rather fortunately, there's quite a good separation between the frequency at which you excite the electrodes and the frequencies at which the brain responds. So it is possible to try to access those small signals while you're stimulating. So we're looking at about, say, 50 to 130 hertz stimulation. And the low beta range, so between about 5 and 15 hertz for the brain to respond. The other really quite big issue is when you bring the wires out, they obviously have to drill a hole in the skull. The wires are non-magnetic, but you get a cluster of wires up near the burr hole in the skull, and then that's brought down inside. But those do cause quite a lot of distortion around that region in terms of your source reconstruction. So really what we're doing in this paper is we've got two things. We're using a placement of a null to null that burr hole. We've published some other work on that to show how it improves the recovery of the spatial sources. What we're doing particularly in this paper is we're using the idea that while your stimulation is on, then in fact you'd expect most of your signal, certainly at the stimulation frequency, to be coming back from that region in which you're stimulating. And hence by exploiting the cross-correlation between the signal you're putting in and the signals you're receiving at the magnetometers, then in fact you can improve your beamformer, especially around the region of interest, which is around the region where the electrodes are implanted. So the idea here is we're looking at stimulation on and trying to get the best set of beam parameters we can, and then we're using a time when stimulation is off to try to verify that. So what they do at the moment is they stimulate all the time. People don't seem to get used to that. That seems to keep working, but there are issues on battery lifetime. So the batteries cost about £10,000, and they don't last for more than a couple of years, so that's quite a major thing, and obviously dangers of infection of putting in a new battery. The other issue, which is becoming more to light, is there does seem some evidence that stimulation affects some of the other areas of the brain, sort of emotional areas, and there's some work showing that actually it would be better not to stimulate so much because of things like behavioural characteristics changing a bit. So a lot of our work, in fact, which we're doing with the Wellcome Foundation support, is trying to actually find an adaptive method where we actually know where to stimulate and where not to stimulate. So I'll describe the beamformer to you fairly quickly, because I say that's really Hamid's work, and I don't think the algebra is probably that new. And then we're going to demonstrate using clinical data from a patient with pain, with DBS electrodes planted in the hypothalamus near the brainstem. So our techniques, the electrode looks something like that. So they're about half a millimeter in diameter, a few centimeters long. They have a number of electrodes on. They have about four electrodes on where you can stimulate. And the sort of the field you're getting around each one is in fact elliptical, approximately. So we're going to assume the LFP data comes from a small elliptical volume around the implanted electrode. We know roughly where that is from looking at CT. You can't use MRI once you've implanted, obviously. You can use CT. We're going to include a null at the burr hole on the skull. And then we're going to use a robust minimum variance beamformer, quite similar to work by Lorentz et al. In 2005. But Lorentz obviously didn't use the particular aspects which are relevant to MEG imaging. So here's our forward model. So the first term here, so YT are the measurements at the skull. S is the stimulation, so that's from the electrode. And AN is the forward model, the lead field vector. Then we have a second term, which includes the burr hole area, so we're going to try to null that out. So that's AN, SNT. And we're assuming that the LFP data is going over a small volume omega here. Again, the location of the burr hole is known, so we can deal with that. And then we've got some noise. There's also, in fact, a time delay going from the, largely because of the instrumentation, between the excitation signal and the signals we're detecting. So just quickly, our problem formulation is to optimize our beam former So we've got y, and we're trying to estimate s. We use an optimization on this. So our first term here is the difference between those, essentially, taking expectations with a value of alpha, which we call a penalty factor, which varies between 0 and 1. So if you put it to 0, you're actually taking no notice of the autocorrelation, of the correlation between the source and the measurements. And then subject to our source vector, so that's where our electrodes are. So we know we've got a source there. This is in the on condition. Okay, and then we're trying to null out the burr hole. So then if we take the covariances of those and take the expectations, then our first term just becomes this one down here. So RYS here is the cross covariance between the source, the excitation we're putting on, and the measurements. So it's a Lagrange multiplier solution, essentially, where we're trying to maximize our cross-correlation term, subject to minimizing constraints, such as certain constraints. You can find the exact solution for W. This is following Lorentz's work, really, which comes out as this top one. E here is one of the parameters which says where, which is the describes the ellipse where you're putting on the excitation. Lambda and mu are Lagrange multiplier constants. If we substitute our value for W back into the burr hole constraint, then in fact we find mu equal to this expression. We then diagonalize that using the normalization below. So V here, sorry, I haven't put it in this, it's in the paper. Part of the diagonalization is we diagonalize the vector r to the minus a half q r to the minus a half transpose. So that's the vector which relates the region of where we know the excitation is to the cross-correlation between the measurements and the excitation. We can diagonalize that and get the secular equation here, which relates our, so mu we found, this relates lambda then, our other unknown, to the eigenvalues gamma I of our normalized matrix r to the minus a half, q to the half. So the details of that are in the paper, and the algebra is in the paper. I'm sorry, I'm going rather fast over it, but I'd like to have time to present the results. And I have got some papers here, if anyone wants to look at them. But the big advantage, the way that actually we've normalized this, so we've normalized here, we've talked about V before, so E and with respect to some of those covariance matrices and also the parameters of the ellipse where we put the excitation. This actually gives us a nice solution which then amenable to an iterative solution to actually find lambda, whereas some previous work has actually only given bounds for lambda. This type of normalization actually allows us to optimize the value of lambda. So we have an algorithm which allows us to do that, which I'm not going to go through now, I think, because of time, if that's okay. So I'd like to produce to you some of the results. So we've done this in simulation. One of the problems, of course, as we all know, when we're doing things biomedically, is it's really hard to try to validate. So we've done validation using a simple simulation of a spherical head model. We've put in a deep source to simulate the excitation. We've put in a source at the burr hole for interference. And we've added some noise. And to ensure that we can sort of look at on and off conditions, we've allowed our source, which would normally be either dominated by the stimulation we put on, or we should be seeing the response to the brain when it's off on different frequencies. We've used sine and cosine waves. So we've compared those with a standard Wiener filter, and we've compared them with the filter putting in the burr hole null, but without the correlation. So here it is, just with interference and no noise. Our method is perfect because we've actually simulated the interference along with everything else that we optimized, we've estimated it. We can see the Wiener filter is actually not as performs well as our improves things as the SIR goes up, whereas that's the method using the beamformer. So when in fact we add some noise as well, which is a fairer comparison, then we can see our method actually does give us advantages over the other two methods. So putting in this cross-correlation term between the source and the measurements, since we know what the source is doing, that frequency actually does help matters. So clinical data is the most interesting. This is a 40-year-old woman with whole body pain, chronic pain she's had for several years. Implant in the PAG, which is close down to the brainstem, at 50 hertz. So the electrodes themselves are non-magnetic, so they don't cause much problem for the MEG. But in fact, where the wire clusters, then you do still get problems. She had an MRI scan, which is standard, before we inserted electrodes, or before TPU inserted electrodes. So MR you can use before, but not after, because you've got metal inside you. And the two scans were registered using the Polyhemus Fast Track method, which is electromagnetic registration. So two things we did. First of all, we recorded the LFP data in the off conditions. So that's actually recording straight off the electrodes. The electrodes are implanted, we used our beamformer, and then we recorded what happened off. So we used the beamformer in on, now we're looking at off. We then reconstructed, using our beamform parameters, what we would have expected to see from the beamforming. So here it is from a Wiener filter. Here it is using the null at the burr hole as well, which actually gives us a bit of the higher frequency, but not very much. And here it is using our own beamformer, the new beamformer. So you can see you've certainly picked up the higher frequencies very much better with the new beamformer. And finally, just the whole point of this is to try to find out what's happening in the brain. So this is really just for the clinical interest, I suppose. And this is looking at the differences between the stimulation off and on. So this woman, in fact, had pain once it was turned off, and she didn't have pain on. Not an entirely good experiment, because she actually knows whether it's off or on. It's best we could do. And you can see you do get some differences between the off and the on condition in the way in which parts of the brain respond. And this particularly looking at parts which are known to be sensitive to pain. So it's the brainstem, the PAG. The ACC is the anterior cingulate cortex, sort of halfway up the brain. And the pre-SMA is the part of the motor response. So this technique actually allows us to look quite closely at spatial areas of the brain where we're getting responses to the clinical stimulation. So our results have improved using correlation. It's allowed us to look more closely and identify more closely spatial regions in the brain. I haven't presented the results, but in fact using elliptical volume for the LFP actually improved things over using a circular volume and still provided us with a good solution. And we've shown some results, improvements using simulation and using clinical data. Thank you.
I'm interested in how applicable this is to the EEG signal rather than the MEG. Obviously, EEG is much easier to apply, et cetera. It is my understanding, I know that MEG is easier to model the lead field matrix, but I understand that if you do model the head reasonably well, like reasonably carefully, EEG and MEG source localization becomes approximately equivalent. Like, that's my understanding. So I'd like to get your comments on how applicable this is to EEG.
Yes, but it is the problem, as you say, that for magnetic model of the brain is actually rather simple, because you can assume that the relative permittivity is one everywhere, which is basically true, except perhaps at the burr hole. Whereas for EEG, it's much more complex, because you've got a much more complex model of the brain. So my understanding, though I'm not expert on what they've done on EEG, my understanding is MEG gives you quite a significantly better result. But I'd be interested to discuss that with you further, actually, and I don't know if anyone's got any information on that. But that's certainly my understanding of it. I mean, MEG is a recent technology. It's come about in the last 5 to 10 years. And we're lucky in Oxford, we have got a MEG machine, but they're not all that many in the UK.
Yes, in the back.
Thank you.
Just comment on your question. MEG signals have better temporal resolution than EEG signals. So that's probably why. But my question is, I understand you showed data from a DBS patient. So this is a patient that has been implanted with electrodes in the subthalamic nucleus, if I understand correctly.
It's not the STN. It was in the PAG, actually, which is next to it.
Okay, so this is for pain?
For pain, yeah.
Okay.
They use STN for motor problems.
Okay, so your readout here is through the MEG, right? And you're trying to estimate the LFP signal from the MEG readouts, right?
Well, we're using, for the final part, we measured the LFP because it's externalized, and then we tried to estimate it as well, yes, using the magnetometer signals, and then we compared them.
Okay, so my question is related to the criterion based on which you're trying to optimize your beamformer is to have the null at the burr hole, right?
Yep.
So why is it that you're not optimizing the beamformer so as to achieve a clinical outcome, a functional outcome?
I suppose it's hard to quite specify what you try to do. I mean, in a sense, we're trying to optimize the signal we're receiving in the off, or even a different frequency, at the point where we stimulate it, because we expect that to be one of the places where there's most effect. But it's quite hard to know how you'd try to optimize it.
Well,
I mean, you could look at a particular
pain response,
region.
Right?
Sorry?
The pain response of the patient. So it's like, you know, you're optimizing a Parkinsonian DBS stimulator. You look at the tremor, and then you tune the stimulation parameters, right? Which is some.
Well, we are doing a spectral analysis as well. So we're looking at particular frequencies.
Okay.
So part of the beamformer is actually looking at particular frequencies. So I think we filter before. I think we do temporal filters on this one. So we are optimizing that to look at sort of the mid-beta range or the low-beta ranges.
Okay.
Otherwise, you see very little, actually.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm. Any other questions?
Yes.
The source that you're activating in the PAG seems very deep within the brain. Most beamformers will struggle to go there.
Yeah, I mean, it is very deep, and that's one of the problems. But that's where they feel they get the best clinical outcome.
Sure. My question was basically more, does your beamformer get accurate results at that level of depth?
Well,
as the LCMV, for example, would struggle, etc.
It's very hard to know, in a sense, isn't it? Because you're not quite sure what you're looking for. So in a sense, I mean, the results where we tried to estimate what we were getting and then measure what we were getting, I mean, that, I suppose, is the best way we can possibly indicate, at least we've thought of trying to indicate how good our results are. But it's a good question, and it's very hard to know how to validate it properly.
Did you try any other beamforming approaches with the same kind of...
No, we've only tried the sort of mean invariance beamforming.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, everyone. Thanks
thank
again,
you.
Penny.